Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. At the end of the show yesterday, the unfortunate news of Mississippi State football coach Mike Leach's passing came over the transom. We actually talked about it briefly with John Holosek, the state champion football coach from Loyola Academy, who we spoke with at the end of the show. And just thinking about what's going on in our schools, and thinking about the role coaches play, including coaches like Amy, maybe the last bastion of adult leadership, stewardship, and judgment in pre-K through post-secondary education. For example, Deion Sanders, we talked about last week because of the criticism he's receiving for taking the bigger, better college football job at Colorado.
How dare he further his career, do what the white man has been doing their entire lives. And women, too.
Do what every man has been doing. Do what every person does, try to further their career, take the bigger, better deal after a successful three-year run at Jackson State where they won two conference championships. But here's Deion's, you know, Deion was prime time and he was this flashy character. He's also a great football player and a pretty decent baseball player, too.
But he grew up into it as a man, I think, as a coach.
This is, you know, turning around Jackson State, the impact he was going to have on historically black colleges like Jackson State because of his star power. Well, this is Deion speaking to his team before classes started this semester.
So awesome.
School, we got school. When we start school today, right? Okay, I want you to listen to me clearly and succinctly. No slides.
Oh, that's awesome.
No slides. No slides. No armpits exposed. No wife beaters. Sit in the front of the classroom and be the perfect gentleman, because when it comes down to it and you need help from that professor, they're going to recall your character and who you've been consistently in that class. No slides. No sleeveless shirts. No armpits exposed. None of that. And make sure you shower before you go to class. And do not, I don't want to get a report that you was in some bull junk with our apparel on representing us. Kids sitting in the back of the class making noise. He's freestyling back to the whole class while I was trying to teach it with Jackson State football shirt on. It's not going to happen. When it get back to me, it's going to get back to your coaches first, but then when it get back to me, it's going to be a problem.
Going to be a problem.
Love that. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Hey, expectations for kids, and that's what they want.
They need leadership. Young men need role models like that.
Expectations, sometimes you're going to get angry with the players or with the kids because you have expectations for them. And they may not appreciate it at the time, but they'll appreciate it as they grow into young men in particular. Mike Leach, who was, colorful and, he's just a character.
One of him in the world.
There's so many clips of him now circulating online. They're fun to go back and watch his football career. He wasn't like the highest of profile, but he had a very successful career. He really made his mark at Texas Tech because of the high-powered offenses that he scripted there. But there's one clip that's circulating. Mississippi State, where he coached until his death, where I guess the receivers in that particular game weren't running their routes hard enough. He was sort of upset with the whole receiving core. So he didn't say anything. He just went back to the sort of back of the sidelines where the team was standing, and there's chairs where the offense can sit down, you know, when they're not on the field, and there were chairs specifically for the receivers, and he just picked up the chairs and folded them up and put them away. You're not sitting down. You don't get to sit down anymore because you're not running the routes properly, you're not running them hard enough, and so
That's
on and so
awesome.
Forth. Just little things like that, and a colorful way to describe his disappointments with his team. I mean, they were sort of John McKay quality, you know, the former USC and Bucks coach who – Tampa Bay Bucks coach who during Tampa Bay in the late 70s when they were the worst team in football famously was asked about his team's execution, and he said he's in favor of it. Mike Leach on not playing hard.
Instead of playing hard and getting a first down and getting a play – then, you know, you want to sit behind a shade tree, eat a fish sandwich, and drink a lemonade with your fat little girlfriend.
Oh, my
God. You want to sit behind a shade tree with a fish sandwich and your fat little girl, drink a lemonade with your fat little girlfriend. Okay. Mike Leach, date package number one, apparently. And this fat little girlfriend thing. I don't know why all of his players apparently had fat little girlfriends, or maybe he was making fun of them, trying to motivate them, but this came up again and again when he would, criticize his players in an entertaining way.
As coaches, we failed to get through to them. As coaches, we failed to make our coaching points and our points more compelling than their fat little girlfriends. Now, their fat little girlfriends have some obvious advantages. For one thing, their fat little girlfriends are telling them what they want to hear, which is how great you are and how easy it's going to be and how... We had a whole bunch of people. Everybody wanted to win the football game, but nobody wanted to play the football game. Well, that defies every level of work ethic that exists with regard to football. And as coaches, we have to solve our failure on reaching them, and the players have to listen. And I'm willing to go to fairly amazing lengths to try to make that happen. I don't know if I'll be successful this week or not, but. But, you know, I am going to try, and there will be some people inconvenienced. And if it happens to be their fat little girlfriends, too bad.
He's obsessed with their fat little girlfriends.
I mean, maybe he's doing that to motivate him, as you said.
I love it.
Because you surround yourself with people who just make you feel good. I don't know.
I wanted to win the football game, and they want to play the football game. We see examples of that in life all the time. Mm-hmm. Coach Leach also offered just some general advice, wisdom from a life lived. So, for example, he would go off on these tangents like providing men and women with advice on getting married in terms of the actual wedding process and ceremony. This is a classic Mike Leach riff.
The women lose their mind. Your fiancée's going to lose her mind. Your mother-in-law is going to lose her mind. Your mom is going to lose her mind.
Oh my.
Several of your sisters and female relatives are going to lose their mind.
Oh my!
And they're going to barrage you with constant questions. What should we wear? And then, which of course my answer was, I don't care. And then, what color should the invitations be? I don't care. What should we have for dessert? I don't care. Should we seat this way or that way? I don't care. But see, I don't care is not satisfactory at all. And you're going to get caught in a catch-22, and I'm certain that you already have. And that catch-22 is, well, I want you to be a part of this too. So what color invitations? All right, the blue ones. Well, I kind of like the tan ones. Okay, the tan ones then. Oh, you're just saying that because you want this over with. You're not even thinking about it, which is, of course, true. What do you want for dessert? I was thinking of strawberry shortcake. Oh, okay. Yeah, strawberry shortcake would be good. Well, what about the blueberry pie? Well, I like the blueberry pie. We could have the blueberry pie. Well, I thought you said you wanted the strawberry shortcake. And it's just going to go back and forth, and they're going to play keep away from you until after you're married. There's no answer you can give that is going to be satisfactory or correct. And if you successfully please a few of them, the others will still be, oh, well, I just don't feel like he's that interested. Yeah, okay, so you need to work late. Go in the back room and read a lot of books. Take the groomsmen out so you make sure that they march in just right and they know exactly, you know, these swell outfits that you picked out or whatever, however you're doing it. And in the end, you'll wish you eloped. You need to find excuses that they'll buy to be as far out of harm's way as you possibly can.
That's like at a post-game press conference.
Well, that's another reason why Dan Proft is single right there, buddy.
Mike Leach, you know, football coach, philosopher. Jim, Tampa, Florida, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. You guys are on such a great point this morning. And coaches, and I extend that to PE teachers too, are the place at school where this wisdom can still happen. And two reasons, they live in a world of merit and they live in a world of rules. And they still have to abide by those two things. Until you can start intentionally running the ball into your own end zone and get points for it, you live in a world of merit and rules. And when you live in those worlds, that's what keeps you grounded.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Jay.
Build good players and good citizens.
You also live in a world of a unit, and you have responsibilities to the other players on the team, and you're held to account for those responsibilities. But right, that the last meritocracy now, of course, sports is not insulated from larger society, and so that's being attacked in sport as well. But it's still largely is the case. I mean, you either can hit the 300-yard drive or you can't. You either run a 4.240 or you don't. So, yeah, you're right, exactly. Bob, Grace Lake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, it's a lot like Mack Brown from North Carolina, who tries to get in with the phraseology of the kids, and although he's like 60 years older than most of them, he's pretty cool. But I'm sure that Mike Leach, when he used the word fat girls, was spelling it P-H-A-T.
Oh, yeah, right, P-H-A-T, yeah. He's down so with the hip-hop lingo. Yeah, okay. And I don't know how the fish sandwich in the shade tree with the lemonade fits into, you know, modern lingo, but okay. There's another great story, Mike Leach story. And this was when I think he was the offensive coordinator for Oklahoma, and it was the Red River Showdown between Oklahoma and Texas. And in the 99, the game, this was the 1999 game, during the pregame warm-up, underhanded script outlining Oklahoma's opening offensive plays spotted on the field by one of Texas's student assistants, scooped it up, took it to the Longhorns defensive coordinator, and it seemed like they caught a break, right? We were trying to figure out if it was authentic, said the defense coordinator for Texas at the time. We were in a state of, can we believe this? They shouldn't have. It was a fake, a plot hatched by Mike Leach, the Sooners offensive coordinator, who gave them the plays that they, gave them plays they were ostensibly going to run, and they, set up their defense accordingly, except that's not the plays they ran. And Mack Brown, speaking of Mack Brown, who was a coach of Texas as well during his career, that does sound like Mike. I do know this. Offensive coordinators are so careful with those scripts, they wouldn't be losing them. Those things are valuable. Only Mike would think to lay one out on the field as a decoy. Classic. Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I was listening to some Mike Leach clips yesterday on my way to work, and it's some different ones from the ones you played. And, when you listen to him, you can tell easily that he's very conservative. And I do remember seeing a few years ago that he publicly came out as a Trump supporter.
Yeah,
which
he
makes
did.
Sense because when you listen to him speak, he's very old school. He's sort of like your get off my lawn type of guy. You know, all these kids today are spoiled type. And when you compare him with a guy like Deion Sanders, I don't know where Deion's politics lie. He's probably, in the middle of the road type of guy. But I know, Amy, you liked what he said during that speech you played. Well, I listened to his very first speech that he gave to his team at Colorado, and was actually very heavily criticized by Jason Whitlock. And what he did, he basically has made the entire speech about himself, and then he also criticized the players for being lackadaisical, even though he didn't coach them last year and probably didn't watch a single game. And he also named his kid as a starting quarterback for next year's team, and his kid hasn't even transferred yet. So Deion's kind of more built like your entitlement culture there, and I just don't really see it working out for him. He got away with a lot of Jackson State because of the level of competition. It's not going to be that easy in the Pac-12.
Well, we'll see. Well,
and we can't say that he didn't watch a game, especially if his son is going to go to school at Colorado.
Well, we'll see about that. I mean, Deion knows a lot about the game and the level of competition. Well, that's Jackson State wasn't meeting the level of competition in the SWAC until he came there. They weren't winning conference championships until he came there. So, you know, whatever principles he applied at Jackson State are certainly transferable to a Colorado program that's in the shambles, too. So I think I'm going to reserve judgment on prime time, and we'll see how he does at effectively the next level.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're pleased to be joined now by the winner of our Business Boost contest. She is Angelica Ford. She's the owner of Fueled by AF. You'll hear more about her business in just a moment. And banking big wheel, Kevin Bastuga from Signature Bank, my business bank. This is the second year we've done this Business Boost contest and program, and it was great success last year, and we're looking forward to helping Angelica Ford grow her business, Fueled by AF. Kevin and Angela, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Kevin, let's start with you and the vision for Signature, the partnership that we have with Signature Bank here at AM560 to do the Business Boost program.
Yeah, so we had started this with you guys years ago in the form of the business tour,
right?
Where
right.
You guys would broadcast from different companies that applied to be, I guess, exposed to your audience, and that worked really well. And then COVID hit,
Wasn't that fun, Kevin?
And then we had to kind of reimagine this thing. So with the help of your program people, we came up with the Business Boost, and it worked well last year. We're happy to do it again, and this year kind of in the form of a Shark Tank kind of episode, and we were thrilled that Angelica was the winner.
Yeah, and it was, I did feel like I was on Shark Tank, and we had a number of people try out, and they presented the reason why we should invest in them. But Angelica, you did such an amazing job, so tell us about your company.
Well, it did feel like Shark Tank, which is my favorite show. So when I came in, I told them about my company, Fueled by AF, which is a small local company here in Chicago that supports and employs individuals with disabilities while providing the best and healthiest snacks possible. So we make homemade protein bites, nut butters, and for the holiday season, we started making gift sets. But our main goal is to keep everyone as healthy as possible and employ as many people with disabilities.
Yeah, one of your employees who has unique abilities joined you for the presentation. I'm blanking on her name. What was her name again?
Her name was Kate.
Yeah, she was great.
Oh, and she was wonderful.
And so, again, same thing here, the vision question. Your vision for this company, both in terms of the product lines as well as the unique approach to employ people with unique abilities.
Correct. Yeah, my vision was, during COVID, I think everyone complained a lot about being stuck at home, but the reality was people with disabilities are always stuck at home most times. They have a hard time finding a job, and it's not because of them. It's because society has believed that they can't function or perform at the highest level. And I don't believe that. So I started employing them, and our company is 28% more efficient than other food companies our size. So we've proven that it's not true. They can function at the highest level. And we have a very efficient company, and we're very successful because we chose to employ individuals with disabilities.
The food products, too, like you're like a health nut, right? You're like you were an Olympic swimmer or something like that.
I wish. In my own mind, I
but
was.
But you were an athlete in college.
Yeah, I was a collegiate athlete, and I went to school for health and fitness. And one of my biggest things is you can't function well if you fuel your body poorly. So my goal over COVID was like I was just cooking and having fun, but I made something that tastes really good and it was really clean. So I started giving them out to customers and clients and they loved them. But going beyond my research, I realized that people with disabilities, you can increase their daily functionality with cleaner food, but the trouble is finding something they love.
Yeah, so, and everything's so processed out there.
Very processed.
And this was just all natural. And I mean, I'm actually hungry right now. I want some of those protein balls. Hopefully, did you bring some today? Okay.
I think someone's hiding them.
Okay. They're very good. But right. Can I encourage you to create a line of vodka?
Because
What fuels me.
Right. Me so, too, but don't tell anyone.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So your dream someday is to have a handicap accessible kitchen to
Correct.
Cook in. So where are you making your products now? And just tell us what the end game is.
So we're currently in an incubator kitchen at the Hatchery in Chicago. And it's working well, but there's few things that, you know, are already set up for a culinary kitchen that just kind of don't work for us. And so we're navigating our way around it. But I think there's a next level component that we can offer to people with disabilities so they can come in and feel included. So lower sinks, prep tables that raise and lower, noise canceling is a huge thing, you know, proper lighting to not cause seizures. So all of those things are taken into account when I'm looking for spaces. And the other biggest thing is we need a little bit more room for people in wheelchairs to go around mm-hmm. the prep tables. And so we make it work right now, but there's definitely another level of functionality we can hit that we're not able to have right now.
And we should remind folks that the Business Boost program, thanks to the generosity of Signature Bank, $75,000 marketing plan for Angelica and for her business, Fueled by AF, to increase the awareness so you can scale the business.
Right. And that's our goal is by getting our name out more and more, hoping that we can find more people with disabilities that like to come work. But in addition to that is increasing our sales to allow us to expand our kitchen space.
And what's your goal? Like Whole Foods, Target, where? The Jewels?
Yes, we've been applying to all of those, and that's our goal, is to expand into all of those regionally within the next year. And my 5-year goal is to be nationwide and to hopefully open another production facility on the West and the East Coast to employ even more individuals with disabilities. Because it's not commonly found.
Love the business. Love the vision. Same thing we say about Signature Bank. Signaturebank.bank for more information about the bank. If you want to consider Signature Bank as your business bank, as it is mine, I'd certainly encourage that. And Angelica's business, Fueled by AF, fueledbyafsnacks.com, fueledbyafsnacks.com. And you'll be hearing a lot more about her business in the coming weeks on our airwaves. Kevin Basug, Angelica Ford, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you both.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Maxwell Frost is the first Gen Z congressman. He'll be seated next month when the new Congress is seated.
Isn't he from Florida?
Yeah, Orlando area. He replaced Val Demings, who ran for Senate against Marco Rubio. 25 years old. He is going to make $174,000 like every other member of the House, at least a baseline. You know, you get bumps if you're in leadership. And he couldn't rent an apartment in Washington, D.C. He failed the credit check.
Oh. Oh, wait, but the story that I read said that the rent was too high and he couldn't afford it.
The rent's too damn high. He's in the rent's too damn high party.
Yeah,
$174,000 and you can't afford to rent an apartment in D.C. No, it was because he had a terrible credit score, which he apprised a prospective landlord he possessed. I ran up a lot of debt running for Congress for a year and a half. Didn't make enough money from Uber itself to pay for my living. He's 25 years old. Prior to running for office, he was a community organizer for the ACLU and for March for Our Lives, gun banners. Well, both camps. And this is what
he
said.
So he's never had a real job?
This is what he said about it. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with driving Uber, but quitting his full-time work was necessary given the demands of campaigning. And what this really shows, his inability to be able to rent an apartment on his own, is that in this country we allow numbers like credit scores to completely define a human. It just shows how much of a problem we have. Oh, he's going to be fun. You know, we can quickly inaugurate him into being an honorary socialist spice girl with AOC and Tlaib and Omar and Presley and Sean Kasten and the rest.
Can't he just live in his congressional office? I remember Joe Walsh did that for a while.
Hardly the point. The larger point is, should you be allowed to hold office if you cannot rent an apartment by yourself?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. The good news is, Dan, he's 25, so he's still on his parents' health insurance.
That is good news for him. it really is something. And then the attitude about we allow credit scores to define us as a human. No, we don't allow them to define you as a human. We just allow them to define your credit worthiness for the purposes of things like renting an apartment. That's what we allow credit scores to do, young Maxwell Frost. But that
of course
entitled,
he thinks it's the credit score is a problem, not him.
The entitled attitude. But I really think, you know, certain things I'd like to see change. You know, ages, we raise the age. No, we don't need to raise the age. If you can't accomplish simple tasks, if you haven't accomplished enough to have the wherewithal to rent with a $175,000 salary to rent an apartment, then you know what? You just don't belong in a position where you're representing the interests of other people because you can't even represent your own. You can't even accommodate your own basic needs like shelter. So I think those conversations would be fun. It's like sort of the conversation about having a collections window at the welfare office, right? If welfare is a hand up, then certainly the state, federal government, state government, would allow people to pay back the welfare like the scene in Cinderella Man. Thanks for providing that. Now I'm going to pay it back because I'm on my feet again. It would just be like things like that that speak of, I don't know, adulthood, where adulthood is called for, like to be the head of a family or to be an elected official.
And he tweeted, "This ain't meant for people who don't already have money." He tweeted that on Thursday.
Right, as he enjoys a salary at 25 that is 2.5 times the median household income in this country. The sense of an entitlement. The Gen Z members of Congress that are coming will be very interesting.
Welcome to what you voted for.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The story that we brought to you first on Monday. This incident at a York High School bathroom in Elmhurst, where a bunch of kids were squirting around in the bathroom and started picking on, at least one of them, started picking on a boy with Down syndrome and pushed him to the ground. The boy retreated to a bathroom stall for safe haven, essentially. This video was sent to me by a concerned parent. We posted it, went viral. It's become really an international story. The Daily Mail has picked it up, mm-hmm. among other outlets.
And it's just sickening that the kids are laughing, Dan. I've watched it dozens of times now. And besides the you-know-what who's videotaping it, but the other kids are laughing. There's one kid in a gray Patagonia sweatshirt who looks like he's kind of sort of defending him, and then the rest are just celebrating the knockdown.
So we have openly asked over the last couple of days, well, does members of the school board want to say anything? They're the representatives of the public. They're elected officials. There's a school board meeting last night.
Oh, I'm sure there was
Elmhurst
a protest,
District,
right?
Elmhurst 205 school board meeting last night. Kara Kaforia is the 205 school board president. And we finally have the school board addressing what transpired. Here's what she said.
While multiple communications have been sent out to York parents, district parents, and to the parents of our students with disabilities, many of you have also expressed frustration in not knowing all the details. Social media is unfortunately and expectedly replete with partial facts, conjecture, and sensationalism. Therefore, I would like to take a moment to clarify the events of last week for our community. Please recognize that we must respect the privacy of our students within the bounds of the law and are not able to divulge all the information that you may desire. Once the administration had a full understanding of the situation, significant school consequences were issued to the students involved.
Mm-hmm. I told you yesterday, my understanding was that the students involved got suspended and the main assailant who pushed that boy to the ground is no longer at York. I got an indication that he transferred to it here. He did or is being transferred to another school.
Oh, great. So he could do it again there? Because you think this is their first time doing that? They seem pretty experienced, those group of guys.
Well, it's getting a little bit more complicated because Elmhurst Police did investigate this. And the family does not want to pursue any criminal charges, so the police department is going to respect the family of the boy with Down syndrome, which is fine. I understand the deference to the family. I also understand because according to the police report, the Elmhurst police report, five students, including the student with special needs, willfully engaging in physical contact while other students observed. At one point, the student with special needs was pushed and fell to the ground. The investigation revealed the student with special needs is a member of the school's wrestling team, engaged in wrestling behavior with four other students, two of whom were his teammates.
Sick.
But it was a student who is not on the wrestling team that appeared to have pushed him to the ground. Also, a female student, who is a student aide for this boy with Down syndrome, escorted him to the restroom. Then she summoned school administrators when she heard, quote unquote, unusual activity in the restroom, according to the police report. So
really, were wrestling? That's what they're going with?
Well, that's the Elmhurst police report.
Okay.
The family is declining to pursue charges. I also have a communication that I haven't authenticated, but it appears to be on some sort of school chat space, if you will, that I believe to be the guy who pushed the kid to the ground, and I'm not going to name his name.
No.
He, if this is the person, and you have some people per this police report doing the same, he is offering a defense saying, you know, I didn't start it. He came in contact with me crossed a line and I pushed him to the ground.
Oh, so self-defense. That's what he's going with. Now, this person that has been moved to a different school, did they do it voluntarily before the punishment came down, or did he get expelled from York High School? Or do we not know because they're minors?
I don't think there was an expulsion. I think they moved. I think my sense is the family moved on it before the school did. For those that are offering an explanation or a defense, well, that's fine. Happy to hear it out. As soon as the parents or the kids in that bathroom want to come forward and explain themselves. You see, that's what's missing, and that's why this police report is unsatisfying.
Yeah,
and that's why it doesn't provide any exoneration, in my mind, for what was done. But, you know, we have to tackle all of the facts in the case and address them as they present themselves. And by the way, Ms. Fior, the school board president, Ms. Kaforia, bitching about social media. Well, sorry, Ms. Kaforia, but you, the school board president, was nowhere to be found before last night's meeting. So if you say, well, we had an investigation and this and that, you know what? There are things that people can say who have a platform, like a radio talk show host or a school board president, that in no way inhibit or corrupt an ongoing investigation. There are things that people can say, and we've said them on this show, and I'll say them again, that have nothing to do with the police, have nothing to do with the school administration. You know what you could say, and it's not just Ms. Kaforia, the school board president. You know what people could say? Say, forget the lawyers and forget the politicians and forget the police and say, you know, parents of these boys, why don't you come forward encourage your boys to come forward and address what happened, maybe in conjunction with that boy with Down syndrome who was pushed to the ground, and let's see if we can't resolve this.
Like men.
And any associated appropriate punishment. And say, you know, there's misunderstandings. There was bad judgment. There was bad behavior. I don't want this to be reflective of who I am forever. I don't want to hide from this. I want to own what I did. Offer contrition. Make amends. Repair the relationship, take the punishment, and then you move on. Instead, everybody has to intercede, and for people that are outside observers, it's hard to make heads or tails of it because nobody is adult enough to talk like an adult and present themselves like an adult to address the situation, the incident, on the merits.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us always on our text line at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Did anybody else speak about it at the board meeting last night?
Yeah, we'll get to it. Okay. But Kaforia, and this is why I've got an additional problem with Ms. Kaforia, the school board president.
Okay.
Because after you heard what she said about the incident and the process and significant school consequences that we can't describe in detail, then you get the waterworks.
Oh, no.
It's because it's about her.
Right, not the victim.
There is no place for this behavior and treatment of students with a disability in our schools. To our wider Elmhurst community, while one incident hurts,
and it hurts deeply. The outpouring of compassion in action from our student body at York High School has been nothing short of amazing. We are so proud of our students for their outrage over this situation and their adamant and immediate response to make it clear to everyone that the actions of this small group do not represent the entire York student body.
Mm-hmm. Protect the shield, just like I said would happen. Protect the shield, talk about the school community, the larger community, York strong, Elmhurst strong, isolated incidents, so on and so forth. Dance around it all, celebrate ourselves.
And cry because, oh, I really do care. Look, I'm crying.
So, maybe that's not the whole, but you know, this one-off kind of deal. Maybe there's something more going on at York that they're trying to cover with tears. Dominic Pegora spoke at the board meeting during public comment. He's a York High School senior, also a member of the football and wrestling teams.
My name is Dominic Pegora. I'm a senior here at York High School, and I'm a part of the football and wrestling teams. After seeing the recent video, I don't believe the correct measures are being taken. The problem with the video was not solely the push, rather the laughing and videotaping that took place after. This all stems from the lack of education at our schools from both the middle and high schools. Students put in that position do not know what to do and fall back on making fun of someone they do not fully understand. When things finally got out of control, no student had the courage to stand up. All that happens in this district is fires are put out rather than prevented. Mm. This all stems from the education taught in our middle school and high school, as said before. Events like these take place in our middle school every day, and nothing is done about it, and no one talks about it. My sister is a sixth grader and has Down syndrome. She is unable to attend Sandberg Middle School due to the mistreatment of kids with disabilities at that school by not only the students, but the mistrained staff, untrained staff. I've heard horror stories of students with disabilities being dragged across the hallway because they cannot sit still. Increased education on how to treat and support kids with disability is not only needed, but vital to create a community of warmth and helpfulness. And that starts with you. Thank you.
So I'm sorry, Ms. Kaforia, a small group of people, one-off incident. That's not what Dominic Pegora says. And he has, as he said, a sister with Downs who's in sixth grade.
Who can't even go to her middle school because of bullying and the staff being, you know, not well-trained to handle it.
That's not what he sees, apparently.
Good for him.
Also, for those who think this was just kids and horseplay and you know, they're on the same wrestling team and so on and so forth. Gross. Dominic Pegora's on the wrestling team. That's not what he saw. That's not what he understands happened.
That wrestling excuse is such bull jive. You don't wrestle in a bathroom. That's gross. Nobody does that. That's a cover.
Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, yeah, when I heard you say about the wrestling thing, I didn't buy that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound even plausible, Amy? No.
Well, no, my foster son wrestled. They would never wrestle in a bathroom. That's gross. No one wants to hang out in the bathroom.
No, that's just a big lie, and I hate when people put stuff out there that's so blatantly lying. I mean, it's lying, Dan. You know, they're covering. They don't want to admit it. That board member crying, saying it doesn't reflect the entire student body. Well, it probably reflects about 75% of them, or maybe I'm overboard.
Thanks for coming. It's not. I don't know what it reflects. That's not germane. Let's say it is reflective of a small percentage. Or fine, whatever. Who cares? This isn't a percentage game. This is how are we addressing this specific incident?
Well, they're lying. Cell phone video showed the student with special needs willfully engaging in wrestling behavior. So they're defending the suspects.
They're not. They're not helping the special needs student.
Who's they?
The police, by saying that in the police report. The video showed the student with special needs willfully engaging in wrestling behavior. Willfully?
Well, again, you have, like, for example, that wrestler and football player Dominic Pegora, when things got out of hand. You know, I don't know the backstory. Oh, let's, you know, meet in the bathroom and we'll go over wrestling moves or something. I don't know if he was invited, if he was lured, if this was to make fun of him, or if it was just to engage in horseplay and then somebody took it too far and then nobody stepped in when it was taken too far. I don't know. But what I do know is that we could know these things if people stood and delivered on the substance of the matter. And that's the fundamental problem here. The parents who are hiding their kids and the kids who are letting themselves be hidden. That's the fundamental problem. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Well, another fundamental problem, good morning, is the fact that our children today are remaining children until their late 20s, early 30s. That's part of it. I don't know if you remember the movie Lucas. That came out when we were kids, Dan. And,
Glenbard West.
You know,
Arlington High School.
Charlie Sheen was the senior, I think, in that movie. And, you know, he was more of the adult than helping out Lucas, the little kid. You know, the kid who was a freshman or whatever he was. You know, I'm not saying that there's high school kids that are good like that, of course. But
Frank, would you say Lucas is your favorite Corey Haim movie?
For sure. It's better than that vampire one.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, no, that was a great film.
Some of it was
taped at Arlington High School, too, the inside.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know. You got to get the Arlington piece in.
Well, I mean, you know.
It's really Glenbard
West. Our high
West.
School was all in it.
Glenbard West was the beautiful storied campus in DuPage County. And, yeah.
It was.
Okay, anyway.
It is a beautiful
You were the
campus.
Gym.
Yeah, right.
One more point I wanted to make about these school boards. You know, when we had Loudoun County School Board, I was surprised at the dais that they had up there. And they were all sitting there like these, you know, great officials up there at the dais. Oh, here we are. We're the school board of Loudoun County. And it sounded like at this one here, they had a pretty good sound system there where the president was talking. Why don't these school boards just get back to being custodians and managing the assets of the district and cut their budgets and cut the taxes of the people in their districts? And not all school boards are like this one here, or seemingly are like this one. But, I mean, you know, you have a nice sound system like that. School board meeting should be at a little table with seven people there.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't need all this stuff. You need to have public comment. But I remember back in 214 years ago, that's the way it was. I remember I had to make a comment or two at 214. They were sitting at some regular tables, and it was just very, you know, they were there, they were up there, but it wasn't like this all these formalities. So anyway, those are my comments about it.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Appreciate it. I mean, I think it's in an auditorium. It wasn't too regal, and they weren't like, you know, Andy Kaufman sitting 12 feet above the audience. So, you know, that wasn't so much of it. But, I mean, it is an unbelievable number. I think they got 9 school board members, and then you got, of course, and a superintendent and 57 assistant superintendents with these the empire building that goes on in K-12 education and the staffing up and doctor this and all that nonsense. So there's definitely some of that. But, the school board. We'll get to more. We'll talk more about that, including Loudoun, because there's a development there.
Yeah.
Marty in Naperville.
Hey, good morning. First of all, as soon as the waterworks start, any leadership position you're trying to assume is gone. Because now it's become about you. So that, you know, that's ridiculous. Second, I'm a product of the 70s schools, 1970s. Back then, if somebody picked on the weak, they were taken care of. And it was just, I maybe be right or wrong, but they would be walking down the hall and all of a sudden something would, you know, become to them. And it was just taken care of differently and it was done. But now it's, you know, I'll bet you if this kid's parents came to the school, it would all be turned around, and you'd probably know exactly why these kids did it if you met their parents. So that's a start right off the bat. But you know, whether it be right or wrong, bring back the bike racks, and this stuff will all get taken care of.
Thanks for the call, Marty. Dirk and Stager.
Good morning.
Morning.
The one thing that I think is really missing from all this coverage is, has anybody got a statement from the Down syndrome kid? I mean, he should be capable of saying what happened.
Yeah, I don't know that. All we know is the police report. Obviously, the police talked to the family. I don't know if they spoke to the boy directly. And, you know, as again, we told you, the police said the family declined to pursue criminal charges, and so they're going to respect the wishes. But that's all we know at this point.
Thanks
for the call, Dirk. And I mean, I would welcome hearing from the boy or his family. I understand why the family wouldn't want to put him out there in the media. So I get that. But the father in response, I mean, again, this is on video. Everybody knows everybody in that community is going to know who these people are. So I don't know what you think you're hiding from. It's going to be known, and you can transfer to another school, and they're still going to know. So why not own it, step up, explain yourself, defend yourself if you want, explain yourself however you want, and, you know, address these matters. It doesn't make any sense why they wouldn't do that.
Well, in response,
particularly if there are any sort of mitigating circumstances.
Right, like if they were wrestling before, because we didn't see what happened at the beginning of the video, so we don't know. But it was, I don't know, a far reach for them to say that he willfully engaged in wrestling.
Well,
so I don't know. I mean,
we have an investigation that the school did, and obviously they reached the conclusion they reached because, you know, everybody got suspended and one got transferred. We believe to be the case, and you heard the school board president, who has to speak in vague generalities, say serious school consequences. So, you know, they handed down punishment. That's obvious.
And as a result, they're going to have a walkout on Friday at 1 p.m., York High School students.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Last week, we brought you the results of this special grand jury investigation into the Loudoun County Public Schools, Northern Virginia. That was a significant factor in last year's gubernatorial election that put Glenn Youngkin in as governor of Virginia. And the rest of the slate, Winsome Sears, Jason Meares as attorney general. We'll get to him in just a second. The special grand jury investigation into Loudoun County Public Schools concluded that the schools, the administrators, I would include the school board members to the extent they had knowledge or should have, quote, "were looking out for their own interests instead of the best interests of students as it pertains to how the school handled two sexual assaults last year." The school responded, but there were no criminal charges filed against anybody. And so the school, in response to this damning report on their conduct, celebrated the fact that nobody had been charged criminally. That was their grand takeaway, which really gives you an insight into the mindset here. In spite of recent allegations leveled against Loudoun County School Board, members of the Loudoun County Public School employees and members of the Loudoun County Public Schools over the past several years, we're pleased the special grand jury's extensive investigation found no evidence of criminal conduct on the part of anyone within LCPS, Loudoun County Public Schools. Not a single indictment was filed as a result of this lengthy process. Hooray! We did a good job.
But they both had to appear before they were both in court yesterday. Both Ziegler and this Baird guy.
And yeah, so that's last week. They celebrated and no criminal charges against anybody. They fired Ziegler, the superintendent, and then
the spokesperson was placed on leave.
And then yesterday, because of the attorney general, you had both the former superintendent and the former district spokesperson charged criminally. And the spokesman is being charged with felony perjury, while the former superintendent is being charged with a number of misdemeanors. Oh, well, now I guess you can't celebrate that nobody's been implicated for criminal offenses, can you, Loudoun County Public Schools? As if that's the standard that the public should expect. We did a terrible job Our malfeasance resulted in at least one sexual assault of a girl in one of our high schools that should have been prevented, that should not have happened. But hey, nobody's been charged, so look at us. Well, look at you now. And Scott Smith, who's the parent of the first girl was sexually assaulted by a trans student, had this to say on the announcement of these criminal charges.
Now, the allegations became... Those indictments today are awesome. They're going to help us keep knocking bricks out of the wall between LCPS and the moms and dads of Loudoun County.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line.
And I just love, I don't know if we read this before, but Ziegler gave an interview to the Washington Post, and he said, quote, "I'm disappointed that an attorney general controlled, secret, and one-sided process, which never once sought my testimony, has made such false and irresponsible accusations against me." It's a grand jury. Doesn't he understand how those work?
I don't understand who's saying
what. Oh, Ziegler said that, the superintendent.
Oh, yeah.
He's upset at that there was a grand jury and he didn't get to participate. Oh, bad, as you say. Oh, so sad. Too bad.
The statement that Scott Smith made, too, it's so illustrative. Great metaphor. Pulling the bricks out of the wall between the schools and the parents. That's what we see. We're seeing it in Elmhurst 205 right now. And that's what you're seeing all over. That's the culture in so many of these school districts, because so many of these school districts are dominated by imperious leftists, frankly. It's not necessarily a partisan or philosophical thing, but it is in significant measure a partisan and philosophical thing. Pulling out the bricks between the parents and the schools. Adversaries. Not partners in their kids' education. Don't you start to get that feeling? Haven't you gotten that feeling yet? Or is to borrow from the sort of couched arguments that are made, passive-aggressive defenses, really, those are just one-offs, anecdotes. Doesn't represent the wide swath of our community. Loudoun strong, Elmhurst strong, Flossmoor strong. Flossmoor.
Yeah, what's going on in Flossmoor?
Family suing HF after their daughter said she was sexually assaulted during a theater class.
Oh, boy.
At the end of October. The family's lawyer said they hope to shine a light on the, quote, culture of sexual and physical violence, unquote, at Homer Flossmoor High School. Well, that's a big allegation. That's more than just whatever is alleged to have happened to this girl in her theater class. The HF administration vehemently denies, we're going to vigorously defend, you know, the usual. We'll see. That's all the reporting on it. We don't have a lot more detail, but the idea that what happened in Loudoun County couldn't happen in HF, couldn't happen in most of these school districts, given the leadership and the disposition of said leadership. This is the big takeaway, whether you're talking about Loudoun County or you're talking about HF potentially, or you're talking about Elmhurst, or you're talking about the myriad other schools that we've talked about on this show. I mean, you have to address the philosophy, because it's the basis upon which these decisions are made, the basis on which the responses are crafted, the processes are set up. You can't divorce one from the other. One helps to explain why the other occurred. So let me give you another example. I mean, we could do this all day with the schools, and we should. Every single one of them, including where your kids go to school. And you should participate, too, if you're not already. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Let me introduce you to the school board member Jennifer Sollett, Upper Moreland Township, Pennsylvania. And the vote for the school board president. When that vote came for the school board president, here's what Jennifer Sollett had to say.
Having said that, I believe that Mr. DeLeo would make an excellent president. However, I feel that electing the only cis white male on this board, president of this district, sends the wrong message to our community. A message that is contrary to what we as a board have been trying to accomplish. I think that it's important that we practice what we preach and that our words have strength when they are spoken, whether we speak them from the neighborhood sidewalks or from behind these tables. Mrs. Steinbeck has done an exemplary job as president these last few months, and the strength of her performance has earned her my vote tonight.
It would be wrong. I mean, first of all, it would be wrong. This guy would make a good board president, but it would be wrong because he's a straight white male. That's what she said.
Yes. Yeah,
that's not what we do here on the school board. By the way, Upper Moreland High School students, 71% student body is white. Not that I care.
Well, but I mean,
if you're going to play identitarian politics, let's talk about what the school district. Let's talk about the composition of the school district, student body, and such. It's a top 10% school according to the academic rankings in the state of Pennsylvania.
Isn't that reverse racism? Or
so think about it. If that was, think about that as like a typical suburban school in a wealthy area here. Like, say,
Stevenson.
Elmhurst or the North Shore. Of course it would happen there. Of course it would happen there. Because in other places, they don't have time for that. I mean, although most other places are suffering from the same poisoning. I mean, you say that at a school this candidate's better than that candidate because of her service, because of her expertise, because of her vision for the school, because of the work she puts in and can put in versus what some other candidate can. And usually these are volunteer positions and so on and so forth. No, we can't send a message that a straight white male can be a school board president in this community. That's what they're focused on. And again, the dominance by the teachers' unions of these school boards is understated. It is underappreciated by most parents, particularly those that aren't at school board meetings and don't have a handle on the politics in the school, which is a small percentage of the parents at any particular school, for sure. Dominated by teachers' union automatons. You can tell, you don't have to look like political contributions or endorsements. You can tell by the political cant. You can tell by the leftist buzzwords that are strung together. The emoting, the sentimentality, the identitarian nonsense. It's not that hard to pick up on, but I don't think people have an appreciation for how dominant that leftist institution, public sector teachers unions, are when it comes to the operation of your kids' schools. And you better get wise to it, like a bunch of left-leaning families in Loudoun County got wise to it, and Fairfax County, and maybe now Elmhurst. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, dictionary.com. All these competing dictionaries coming out with their words of the year. Dictionary.com's word of the year?
What?
You wouldn't think this is new or particularly controversial, but...
Gaslighting, what is it?
If you think that, then you haven't been paying attention to what's happening in culture. Woman. Word of the year.
What?
Woman. Our selection of woman as our 2022 word of the year reflects how the intersection of gender identity and language dominates the current cultural conversations and shapes much of our work as a dictionary. More than ever, we're all faced with questions about who gets to identify as a woman or a man or neither. Right. I think, news to dictionary.com, I think Mr. Rogers settled this some time ago.
Boys are boys from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Girls are girls right from the start. Everybody's fancy, everybody's fine. Your body's fancy, and so is mine.
Next year's word of the year will be fancy. Cambridge Dictionary is updating its definition of woman to the point of dictionary.com that it's much in controversy. To include anyone who identifies as a female. Sure, following the lead of the NHL. And this is important because tolerance of such identity, that's not enough. Nancy Pelosi provided great confirmation of what we on this show have long known to be true, that tolerance is a synonym for acceptance, is a synonym for celebration, according to the left. There are no distinctions. So don't speak in the parlance of tolerance anymore. That's simply not good enough.
And I said, tolerance has nothing to do with it. That is a condescending word to us when it comes to our community in San Francisco. This is about respect. This is about taking pride. About taking pride. And it's about time that we do so. At the federal level.
Bend the knee. That's what peaceful pluralism is to Nancy Pelosi. You shall bend the knee. You shall jump when you shall say how high when I say jump. You shall celebrate what I tell you to celebrate, as they were yesterday celebrating the codification of the redefinition of marriage into federal law.
And did you see who they went live to? Don Lemon. He and his fiance were there reacting to the ceremony.
Probably debating what a woman is. Kevin Stewart is an assistant professor of political science at the University of St. Thomas and founding member of Strong Families of Taylor, as in Taylor, Texas. Professor Stewart, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the Christmas parade in small town America, in the small town in which you reside, Taylor, Texas, what's happened?
Well, the Christmas parade was one of the things that actually attracted us to this town when we were looking to see where we would raise our three boys. And it's always been a very unifying town gathering. The whole town turns out. It's decorated cars. It's the firefighters. It's floats from local churches. It's exactly what you would think of with this great tradition of Christmas parades. That is until last year. When one of the floats was the local Taylor Pride organization, an LGBTQ organization, and it wasn't so much that they had a float, but what was on the float, because it included two drag queens and another person dancing rather suggestively with no shirt. And this is on streets lined with kids.
It's not just for libraries anymore. Is what you're saying. They're moving beyond the libraries. They're taking it to the streets, like the Christmas parade and the Pride parades, that where you see such things like in places Chicago. We're very familiar.
That's vulgar.
It all just melds into one big celebration. Anytime we're celebrating anything, it necessarily must include celebration of LGBTQ on their terms.
Right. Well, I mean, as you might imagine, some parents objected to this to the organizers of the parade. And it's important to say the organizers of the parade are a consortium of churches. So it's a private group that organizes the parade. And so this year, for this year's parade, they took steps to specify in the rules that you can't have any floats that contradict traditional Christian teachings or biblical values. And the Pride organization took that to mean that their float with a drag Santa would not be allowed. And so they complained to city officials. And this is where things get really interesting for me as a political scientist, because we're supposed to live in a country that values democratic participation. But what happened next was the opposite of that, because the city workers, instead of letting the city's elected officials have a voice in this, instead of letting the people of Taylor have a voice in this, the city staff themselves took it upon themselves to create a new and second parade specifically for that one group that thought it would be excluded. Now, it's important to say they never actually applied for the parade this year, but they thought for sure they could not do what they did last year. And so the city staff, who have been elected by no one, created a whole new parade so that that group could participate.
So is that parade going to go after the first parade, or how is it going to work?
It's going to be a parade.
That's
fight.
How it works. So they had the traditional Christmas parade of lights.
Yes.
First, and then immediately following it was the city's more generic holiday parade that had actually in the end only a few participants who were not city employees. It had city employees, fire and police, and then it had the Taylor Pride group, and then just a one or two or three other participants.
Well, were the drag queens on there? Were they scantily clad and dancing?
Oh, there were even more. So there were three. I think the most egregious example, so that we can all tell what we're talking about here, right, okay, is the drag queen whose name was Sit on Your Face. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now, just so we understand the issue. The issue isn't, hey, somebody else wants to have a parade, use the public domain, use the public streets. Well, that's all well and good, but as a private group, we get to use the public space on our terms, too, consistent with our freedoms. So it's not you can't have access to the public space. It's our access to the public space per what we want to do does not necessarily need to accommodate your access to the public space at that time and place. That's the whole point of shared public space.
Right. I mean, there's a Taylor Pride event in June, as cities across the country have as well. When that group goes through exactly the process you described, they get a permit, they go through all the same process to use the space, the public space, to demonstrate in the way that they prefer. And then, of course, all of us who are parents are duly warned that right, this is not a family-friendly environment, that's not a place for kids, and we keep our kids away at that time. But we should not have to keep our kids away from a Christmas parade.
Right. And the other thing that you're raising, and you talk about this in your piece in the Journal, is this, and we saw this on, you know, full display during the response to COVID that persists, the deference to expertise and to particularly bureaucratic expertise. And so what you have here is, as you were mentioning, unelected city officials that have a particular philosophy, surprise, surprise, and they're taking it upon themselves to essentially legislate. They're usurping the authority of the elected officials, and the elected officials stand idly by, and we got a problem there.
That's right. So it's important for people who live in suburbs and small towns across the country to understand why this is happening, why they're being pulled left. And the reason is because working in city administration is a profession that people move up in and where they're paid very well. I mean, I learned in this process, yeah, for example, even though I'm a political science professor, I was surprised to learn that the salary for our city manager is actually quite high. The total package, the internet informed me, the total package is about $185,000 a year, which is very good compensation. It would make him one of the highest salaried people in town. So these are great jobs and a profession that people move up in. But because the bigger the city, the more likely it is to be progressive, that means people are auditioning. When they're working for your small town, they're auditioning not for the job that they currently have, but for the one that they want. And that, and the one that they want is probably more in a city more progressive than your own. And so they're going to be pulled by their profession in that direction. Now, that can be managed as long as there's vigorous democratic accountability, right? Small d democratic accountability to the people of the town.
Well, no, so, that's a great point about the professionalization of municipal management and what the implications are. It's a great point. So what the elected officials, where are they? What are they doing?
Well, the council was not consulted on this. And
so then somebody was fired, of course.
Well, that I think it remains to be seen. No one has been fired yet, but the council is beginning to get involved in looking at how all of these decisions were made, who made them, why they did, why they didn't consult the council, all of these sorts of questions.
Well, would you be okay with an LGBTQA+ float if they didn't have drag queens on it? I mean, why the need to have drag queens on it? Because I thought this was about waving at Santa and celebrating the birth of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I don't think there would have been some perhaps low level rumbling, but I don't think you'd have seen anything near the controversy that we have if there had not been the sort of egregious display of sexuality that we saw last year and then again this year.
Well, just be lucky you don't have a satellite campus of Francis Parker High School out of Chicago in Taylor, Texas yet. Could get worse. He is Kevin Stewart, assistant professor of poli sci, St. Thomas University. And Professor Stewart, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with the situation down there in Taylor, Texas.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. While Sam Bankman-Fried was being arraigned in the Bahamas, newly installed FTX CEO John Ray, who does
cleanup
corporate bankruptcies, most notably Enron, he was testifying before Congress on what he has found so far before a congressional committee. He says about $7 billion is missing. That's a problem. And he explained why.
The FTX group is unusual in the sense that, you know, I've done probably a dozen large, you know, scale bankruptcies over my career, including Enron, of course. Every one of those entities had some financial problem or another. They have some characteristics that are in common. This one is unusual, and it's unusual in the sense that literally, you know, there's no record keeping whatsoever. It's in the absence of record keeping. Employees would communicate, you know, invoicing and expenses on Slack, which is, you know, essentially a way of communicating for chat rooms. They use QuickBooks, a multi-billion-dollar company using QuickBooks.
QuickBooks?
QuickBooks. Nothing against QuickBooks. Very nice tool, just not for a multi-billion-dollar company. There's no independent board, right? We had one person really controlling this. No independent board. That's highly unusual in a size company, this is. And it's made all more complex because we're not dealing with, you know, widgets or, you know, or something that's tangible. We're dealing with crypto. And the technological issues are made worse when you're dealing with an asset such as crypto.
What isn't complicated, though, as Ray testified, Enron was high-level executives trying to cloak transactions. This
was just,
he described, good old-fashioned embezzlement.
Yep, not sophisticated operation. They're just taking money.
Taking client funds and using it personally, whether it was for $70 million worth of campaign donations to the Democrat Socialists or Bahamian real estate or whatever.
But Dana, I loved when Damian Williams, he's the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, he came out and said it, that he was using his money to buy influence and public policy in Washington.
And all of this dirty money was used in service of Bankman-Fried's desire to buy bipartisan influence and impact the direction of public policy in Washington.
Yeah, that's not illegal. What is illegal and why he's also charged with FEC violations, campaign finance violations, is because he was making donations with using other people as pass-throughs, you know, putting their name on money that he was passing through to particular candidates. So in addition to wire fraud and securities fraud and money laundering, and you've got the campaign finance violations. Now, speaking of Mr. Williams, why the feds chose to move on him now when he was scheduled to testify today before that same House Financial Services Committee that you, that John Ray testified before? Why move on him now? This was a question that was raised by George Washington law professor Jonathan Turley.
Well, this is the first time in my memory that prosecutors, rather than a defense attorney, stop someone from making self-incriminating statements. This was a windfall opportunity for the prosecutors. He was willing to go forward with hours of rather hostile cross-examination on every detail in the case. Why wouldn't you want that to happen? That's all admissible. He hadn't been arrested. And yet they decided to move this rather quickly, have him arrested just before he was going to take that step. He's already done great harm to himself, in my view, as a criminal defense attorney, with his public statements. But this was going to be absolutely overwhelming in terms of its benefits for the prosecutors if they let him go forward. So it left a lot of us scratching our heads. I mean, why would you do that? You could just wait for a day. Maybe they'll explain that. Now, part of the motive may be that they wanted to show that they have enough evidence. They're not protecting him or delaying any action against him because of his strong Democratic connections. That could well be true. But they really did him something of a favor here by moving the schedule forward. Because he may have just wrapped, if testified, he could have wrapped up the case against himself.
Yeah, or maybe there's something else. I don't know, but it is very curious, and there are some arguments to the effect of in his, from leaked pages of the testimony he was going to offer to that House committee, he was going to blame everybody in the company but himself. Well, so what? Well, how would that negatively impact the government's case against him? What, the, like, taint the jury pool? Maybe he was duped by these other executives at FTX? I don't think so. I think it's more likely that the federal government isn't trying to protect Sam Bankman-Fried. They're trying to protect Democrats who Sam Bankman-Fried was underwriting.
You know, like Chuy Garcia, who's going to run for mayor, he got $200K from him.
That's the question that should be put to these prosecutors, because remember, the Department of Justice hopelessly politicized. You're talking about U.S. attorney here for the Southern District of New York, spending a lot of their time going after Trump, Trump Organization, anybody with the last name Trump. So I'm sorry, I'm not going to give them a good government pass on this. I am going to view them with a jaundiced eye because they've earned that. And I'd like to know an answer to Professor Turley's question, because it's a good one. Why not let him testify and offer more incriminating statements in the public domain, as he has in previous interviews on Good Morning America with the Wall Street Journal and so forth? I don't get it. By the way, one, a humorous note. I love at his arraignment in the Bahamas. And by the way, I know the headlines, he's fighting extradition. Well, he's going to lose that fight.
Yeah.
That's a joke.
And he can't post bond.
The argument for bail was
what?
His vegan diet and his ADD medication.
Well, and he should have thought about that before he committed the crime.
We were talking to Jim Urio yesterday, and we came up with the welcome back Cotter test for investing.
Yeah.
If the person who wants to manage your money has a haircut like Juan Epstein and welcome back Cotter, don't give him your money. And yesterday it was like almost a Juan Epstein play, like, please excuse my son from jail, signed Sam Bankman-Fried's mom.
Well, his mom and dad are with him in the Bahamas.
For more on this, pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist and Govzilla author. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Quite a day with respect to Sam Bankman-Fried and the FTX Bankman-Fried crypto politics on the Hill. What about that? I mean, do you think it's fair, given his the check writing he was doing, legal and illegal, that about why the federal government moved on him?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I think there's so many cross currents to this story, and I want to hit on two quick ones that you guys didn't mention. I think the most interesting thing about this story is, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried, I have a grudging admiration for this man. I mean, the way he duped these idiot investors, he would literally go into these meetings and say, I care about the climate. I care about racial injustice. Oh, okay, here's $5 million. Yeah, you're a great guy. I mean, this is what the guy's brilliant. He understood how idiotic and lunatic these leftists are, that they somehow, because he thinks like they do, and he mouthed all their, platitudes, that somehow he was somebody who was going to invest their money wisely. These people were that stupid, Dan and Amy. They deserved to lose their money. I mean, my God, he was like, who was the woman who, just went to jail for the drug? Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know how they did it, but people can be so stupid. And I just admire that he understood. He just basically duped these liberals out of their money.
Yeah, well, not all rich people are smart. But what's number two?
Yeah, the number two is, and by the way, I'm going to try that. I'm going to try that, Dan. I'm going to go into these meetings and say, I care about the environment. Mm-hmm. I care about racial injustice. I care about income inequality. Will you give me, $5 million of your money? I mean, unbelievable. Second, when we need to have a campaign to force these Democratic organizations and these Democratic candidates to give this money back to the investors who many of them were just mom and pop investors who lost, their life savings because of this. And you get these Democrats who simply are refusing to give the money back. I find that to be reprehensible.
Well, how much did President Biden get? Do we even know?
I don't know.
It was tens of thousands.
Giver. Yeah, tens of thousands. And the woman from California who is always on the take, who's the head of...
You're going to have to be more specific. Yeah.
Oh, exactly. what's her name?
She's been on that.
Maxine, yes, thank you. She's taken all this money.
And
She took money. She took money from Fannie Mae during the crash of the housing market. I mean, she lines up with these donors. I think we just need to have a crusade to force them to. She gave huge amounts of money to the Democratic National Committee, in some cases, money was given to Republicans. They too should have to give that money back, and they should be legally required to do so. Look, if I put a gun to your head and steal your money, and then I give the money to a friend of mine, that friend has to give the stolen money back.
Right. Yeah. No, fair.
And you should hear Maxine Waters yesterday, all indignant about this.
This committee will not stop until we uncover
stop.
The full truth behind the collapse of FTX.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
Tireless.
I thought
tireless.
Of you, Steve.
Oh, are you making that up, or is that true?
No, that's true.
No,
I was homesick yesterday. I watched the whole thing. I'm like, that's ironic.
That woman have absolutely no shame whatsoever.
She also, Maxine Waters also announced that she would be joining O.J. Simpson and looking for the real killers. And she's not going to stop until they're found.
No.
Stephen Moore, we got some good inflationary news yesterday. Yeah. The dragon of inflation has been slayed by Jerome Powell, and we're right on schedule to get back to low inflation by 2025.
Yeah, I love the spiking of the football in the end zone because we got
mission accomplished
all the way.
all the way down to 7.1%. Woohoo! It's only the highest inflation rate in 35 years. But congratulations. I tip my hat to Joe Biden. I didn't think he could do it. And by the way, they may even get that inflation rate down below 7%. Wouldn't that be an amazing feat? Of course, it was 1.5% when Trump left office. So, you know, look, it is good news. Inflation is coming down. But, you know, we've had now, since Biden came into office, prices are up 15% across the board. So this is hardly, a positive story for Biden. And it's caused real hot problem for people. You know, you look at, I think I mentioned this last week on your show, but credit card debt is surging because people are trying to maintain their normal, you know, shopping list and living standards. And because they're keep falling behind in terms of the cost of things versus their wages, they have to go more into debt. And by the way, the worst way to go into debt is to ring up your credit card, right? Because what is the interest rate on an unpaid credit card? Like, you know, 20%. And so, we have real problems ahead for the U.S. economy, I think. And so to be doing this kind of victory lap is a little premature. But I know we're running out of time. I got to mention one other quick thing, because I think it's been on my mind, and I just wrote a column on this, but I want your listeners to be aware of this. You know, there was a big story that was covered by CNN yesterday that the vaccine for COVID has saved 3 million lives. That was the estimate. Now, I actually think that's a high estimate, but, you know, even if they're up by 50%, let's say it's 1.5 million lives saved. You know, that's a great accomplishment. Now, here's the interesting, I read the whole story and I read the entire study itself. Guess whose name was never mentioned in that?
Dr. Fauci's.
Donald Trump.
No, Donald J. Trump.
Ah.
They never mentioned
Operation Warp Speed.
They never mentioned it. Now, you go back a year and a half or 2 years ago in Trump's last 6 months in office, the media laughed at Trump. Oh, my God, we could never have a vaccine in 9 months. Hell, man, it's going to take – the New York Times said it's going to take 3 to 5 years to get a vaccine.
Well, all the Democrats said they wouldn't take the vaccine. Remember Kamala Harris? We're not taking a Trump vaccine.
They wouldn't take it. Now they're saying, oh, it saved 3 million lives, not mentioning the fact that if it had not been for Trump and Operation Warp Speed, which, by the way, Dan, you know this, was basically a deregulation program. It's like, get the government the hell out of the way, and we can get this vaccine done. And they – don't you think they might have just said, hey, you know what? Trump was right. He was right about getting this vaccine out the door. Now, look, I'm not telling people they should take a vaccine. I'm not an anti-vaxxer. But the truth is that those initial doses of vaccine did save a lot of lives. Thank you, Donald J. Trump. Since no one else will say it, and since I work for him, I will say it.
Stephen Moore, economist and author of GovZilla. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Have a great week. Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Take a bow, Chicago. Yeah. How about it, huh?
What are we celebrating?
After a mere 9 years and at a pittance of, you know, $800 million, I guess, is what they're claiming. I suspect they're rounding down. After a mere 9 years and $800 million, the Jane Byrne interchange is expected to be complete within the week.
Remember when it first started? I said, what's going to happen first?
Rapture.
The Jane Byrne interchange being completed.
It only came in at 2x the projected time for completion. It only came in, with also, by the way, twice the time it took to build the Golden Gate Bridge in the 1930s, and only 50% over budget. So, again, Illinois political ruling class, your trade union financiers.
And they'll have a red, you know, ribbon-cutting ceremony, too, I'm sure, with all the politicians touting, like, look at this great job we did. And Pat Quinn, at the time, who was running for governor, was trying to get the women vote, so he named it the Jane Byrne intersection.
I tip my hat to the Illinois political ruling class, their trade union financiers, and all of the dopes in the city and the state that made it possible. Wonderful, wonderful job.
Well, we'll see if it's effective, too, when it's done, because I don't know how it's going to increase the traffic flow. But
enough celebration. There'll be plenty of time to celebrate and enjoy the Jane Byrne interchange. Done right. Done the Chicago way at 2x the time and 50% over budget.
And it really
wonderful.
Was a shorter time to build the Golden Gate Bridge?
Yeah, by a factor of two.
Back
absolutely.
In the
1930s
yeah,
when the Golden
yeah.
Gate Bridge was
oh, okay.
built.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Boy, it's going to be a week of revelry when that ribbon
when
is cut at the Jane Byrne Interchange. I'm really looking forward to that. It's going to be a Merry Christmas after all this year.
Well, they better clean up all the graffiti because it's plagued the whole area.
All right, let's turn our attention to sports and politics.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
All right, in this installment of sports and politics, we've got two European football stories for you.
Because I know you love soccer.
Well, I mean, and I guess... We got a final matchup between Cambodia and Trinidad and Tobago or something.
No, it's Morocco and France.
Country is
and
in the world.
Morocco and France are playing each other, and then the winner of that game is going to play Argentina.
Right. I mean, whatever.
First non-European country to make it.
Grant Wall is this soccer journalist who made a big splash when he arrived in Qatar because he was wearing some LGBT garb. And he was stopped by authorities, and he wouldn't take off his LGBT garb, and then they were going to award him a Nobel Prize or something. He collapsed and died while covering the World Cup in Qatar last week.
I know, and everybody thought he was poisoned.
Including his brother. Here's what Eric Wall, who is gay, he explains, believed there was foul play.
My name is Eric Wall. I live in Seattle, Washington. I am Grant Wall's brother. I'm gay. I am the reason he wore the rainbow shirt to the World Cup. My brother was healthy. He told me he received death threats. I do not believe my brother just died. I believe he was killed. And I just beg for any help.
Yeah, look, I'm sorry his brother died, and you don't want to criticize the grieving, but it's reckless to play politics with this, and that recklessness has come back to make fools of people like Eric Wall, who suggested without any basis that this was the result of foul play or the result of a toxic climate against LGBTQ, which is true in Qatar. And that's the choice, by the way, for the U.S. to participate. But, it all plays into our domestic politics here. And that's how it was used by the left. And here do we find out after an autopsy, and this from his wife, by the way, Grant Wall's wife, that he suffered an aortic aneurysm. It's just one of those things that had been likely brewing for years, his wife, Celine Gounder, told the hosts of CBS Mornings, ruling out any suspected foul play in her husband's
death. And the sportscaster even wrote on his one of his social media pages that he wasn't feeling well. He hasn't been feeling well in a while, but he decided to go to cover the World Cup anyway. But people left that out of the story.
Yeah, he had bronchitis or something. Is that a contributing factor to the aortic aneurysm? I don't know. I'm not a medical doctor. But regardless, it's unfortunate that he passed away. I can understand the family grieving. I find it noxious that you wanted to force feed this into the left's politics here because of the virtue signaling he did when he was in Qatar. Without foundation, and that's what it was, including by his brother. Okay, well, that's one.
So if that's what the autopsy showed, then that's what it is.
Number two, you mentioned Argentina. They have a soccer team, and they're still playing in this thing.
Yes,
apparently.
They made it to the championship game, Dan. We're waiting for the France-Morocco game.
Yeah, bated breath. So the Argentina shouldn't be allowed to play in the final.
Why?
What do you mean, why?
Why?
Haven't you heard?
No.
The Washington Post reported it, Miss Jacobson.
What?
Why doesn't Argentina have more black players?
Oh, my God.
Argentina is far more diverse than many people realize, but the myth that it is white, a white nation, has persisted. Why don't they have more black players in the World Cup? Doesn't Argentina? Washington Post asking the question. A perspective from Erica Denise Edwards, who's some race hustler at the University of Texas, El Paso, the Miners, who wrote some book about, you know, race hustling and Argentina. Yeah. As fans keep up with Argentina's success in this year's World Cup, a familiar question arises. I don't know where it's familiar, within her circle maybe. Why doesn't Argentina's team have more black players? In stark contrast to other South American countries such as Brazil, Argentina's soccer team pales in comparison in terms of its black representation. So do you think Argentina should be, I mean, I don't care who plays in this silly little event, but do you think Argentina, just on principle, even if you don't, if you agree with me that soccer's not a sport, should not be allowed to compete in the World Cup ever again until they reach some level of black player representation on their team that's acceptable to journalists who write for the Washington Post? I think that's fair.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. But mostly, you know, the population of Argentina, 97% is Spanish and Italian.
So what?
So
more black players.
Non-white groups make up about 3% of the country.
More black players.
No, you want to put the best players on the court, or on the field, excuse me.
That's ridiculous. There's a move in the NHL now to have like a black-owned team and more black players in the NHL. We talked about that. Maybe a Texas Western, like a starting five that's all black. It doesn't matter if they can skate. And I'm not saying black athletes can't play hockey and can't play. It's just what people choose to play. I don't care. I don't care if the NHL is 99% white or 99% black. I don't care. Same with the NBA, for that matter, or any other sport. I'm completely indifferent, and that even calisthenics like soccer, completely indifferent. I'm just pointing out the folly of the identitarians who obsess about this. Yeah, in 2010, Argentina's government census noted that 149,000 people were black. You know, they had 149,000 black residents, black citizens of Argentina. That's less than 1% of the country. So how many black players does Argentina need to have? So the Washington Post stops running these think pieces about the number of black players on Argentina's soccer team.
Trying to make noise, trying to draw attention to herself.
Yeah, why doesn't it? Somebody tweeted in response to an Argentinian tweet in response to this. Pretty funny. Why doesn't Argentina have more black players in the World Cup? The response, because we're a country, not a Disney movie. Yeah. We're a country, not a Benetton ad. So we have this team, and it's for the best soccer players. Like, we have this team called the Chicago Bulls, and it's for the best, you know, at least some of the best basketball players in the world, as represented by the other teams in the NBA as well. And, you know, that's so whatever the composition is the best five players we thought we could put on the floor night after night for 82 games a year. That's the thinking behind it. That's the sum total of it. That's not good enough. Okay, well, that's fine. Then we'll just do something else with sports. We'll conceive of them differently. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just thought it's interesting that you would get this sort of, you know, forcing through the racial prism that, you know, nothing is exempt. Not even this pastime for the third world called soccer. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion? There's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One of the values of Elon Musk's time at Twitter, at least so far, really has very little to do with Twitter. It's somewhat Trump-like in the way that he is exposing the censorious left for who they actually are, and hopefully presenting to the public a clear picture of just how far removed the censorious left is from anything resembling First Amendment jurisprudence in this country. Anything resembling it. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. We played this yesterday and chatted about it a bit with Dan Henninger from the Journal, Wall Street Journal. This was Karine Jean-Pierre at a White House briefing earlier this week, responding to the Musk tweet about Tony Fauci, which has been alternatively denounced by the left as both LGBTQ-aphobic, because he invokes pronouns, as well as dangerous to the well-being of Tony Fauci, because he dares to suggest Tony Fauci should be prosecuted for his performance during COVID. Listen.
These attacks, these personal attacks that we have been seeing are dangerous on Dr. Fauci and other public health professionals as well. They are disgusting, and they are divorced from reality. And we will continue to call that out and be very clear about that. Again, these are incredibly dangerous, these personal attacks that we are seeing. Dr. Fauci has served under 7 Republican and Democratic presidents. We cannot forget that. He has given his almost entire career to civil service, as a public servant. His work on infectious disease from HIV/AIDS to COVID has saved countless lives. And, you know, it's unfortunate that he has, we are fortunate, I should say, that he has devoted his career and his life and his exceptional talent to America's public health. And that's what should be discussed right now. That's what we should be thankful to him about. And again, these are incredibly dangerous and should be called out. I'll leave it there.
I mean, the tweet, my pronouns are prosecute/Fauci. Merits a dangerous to the third power diatribe from the White House press secretary.
Don't you think he was being a little sarcastic?
Don't care. Who cares? What does that have to do with danger? What does that have to do? I mean, what she offered there is what New York State has codified into law. That's where this goes. The hate crime or hate speech law in New York that requires blogs like the one Eugene Volokh runs, or like the one our friend Professor William Jacobson runs, Legal Insurrection, to respond to comments, or to have a policy of responding to comments that, quote, vilify, humiliate, or incite violence against a group, you know, the way that Karine Jean-Pierre defines it, which is boundless. Based on, quote, race, color, religion, ethnicity, national origin, disability, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. As defined by the state. As defined by the political left. As if the two are distinguishable. Eugene Volokh joins us now. He is a UCLA law professor. He's also the founder of the Volokh Conspiracy blog, and he penned this piece that we talked about earlier in the week in the Journal about this New York state law and its implications for bloggers like him and, a free people like we would like to be, I think. Professor Volokh, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So have you gotten any response from the state officials to your argument that they're that this law that was passed is conscribing you to be to violate your First Amendment rights?
Yes. In fact, yesterday, as per the deadline set by the court, we got a response from the New York Attorney General's office. and they're going full bore, as is their job as lawyers, to defend the statute. So the law is titled Social Media Networks, Hateful Conduct Prohibited. But to be fair, in the body of the law, it doesn't actually prohibit any that hateful conduct. They mean certain viewpoints that they find, that they believe are improper. It doesn't actually prohibit them or order me as an operator of a blog or Rumble as an operator of a social media network to block them. It does require us to have policies and to publish policies on how we would deal with such hateful conduct. And we thought from reading it, it requires us to respond to people's complaints, because it says that each social media network shall have a policy which includes how such social media network will respond to reports of incidents of hateful conduct on their platform. Hateful conduct, again, just being certain what some people label hate speech. In the response, the New York Attorney General's office says, actually, we don't have to respond at all. Even though the statute says it has to explain how we will respond to such incidents, they say it's okay to have a policy that just says we don't care about incidents of hateful conduct. So they describe this law, which is titled Hateful Conduct Prohibited, as really doing almost nothing other than requiring us to have a policy which could be just sort of an empty policy.
Or the policy.
Know, that's a step forward, at least.
Or the policy could be like, I respond as I see fit. Like,
exactly.
That's a policy, right?
Exactly. And look, that's better than requiring us to have some sort of militant policy or requiring us to actually send responses to complaints. It's hard for me to see how that's reconcilable with the text of the statute, but
right.
I think they're deliberately reading the statute super narrowly in order to minimize problems. But
yeah,
they also claim...
Sorry to interrupt, but the problem, of course, is so they're being challenged. They know they don't have a constitutional leg to stand on, and so they're, you know, again, offering the interpretation you described. But you still have them moving down a path, and they're going to move down that path, I would suspect, as quickly as they're allowed to. But that doesn't mean that just because they're now backing off a little bit in terms of their interpretation doesn't mean that their end game is any different.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And in fact, the title of the law, which is not the law itself, it's not the text. So I want to stress that. But the title of the law shows, I think, where they want to go. They call it Social Media Networks Hateful Conduct Prohibited because that's what the New York government would like to do. That was their plan. Perhaps they didn't delete it from the title when they were alerted that they weren't allowed to do it. But their goal is to do as much as they can to restrict viewpoints that they disapprove of. So, for example, vilify or humiliate on the basis of religion, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Of course, many people think that the claims that transgender athletes shouldn't compete on women's sports teams think are humiliating based on gender identity, or for that matter, sharp disapproval of particular religious beliefs may be seen as vilifying or humiliating based on religion. Those are all things that this law requires there to be a policy about. But you're right. I think their hope is to try to suppress those kinds of viewpoints as much as they can through both this law and its future follow-ups.
Well, who decides what hate speech is?
Well, here the government defines hateful conduct to include speech that vilifies, humiliates, incites violence against a group or class of persons on certain bases. So they say that under this law, I could have a policy that just says, you know, I don't respond to anything, and then just complainants will decide what they think is hate speech. They send me an email, let's say, and then I say, I don't care. So their claim is the government isn't going to get involved in enforcement here. However, it's still a viewpoint-based law that imposes a legal obligation, even if a relatively modest one for now, on platforms precisely because the government is trying to suppress a viewpoint. Interestingly, the New York Attorney General's papers defending the law argue repeatedly that the law is content neutral because, again, we could have a policy that doesn't mention even hateful conduct, even though on its face it singles out particular kinds of viewpoints as the sort of thing that the government is trying to at least deter and that I'm required to have a policy about. I'm not required to have a policy about speech that offends based on politics. I'm not required to have a policy on anti-police speech or anti-American speech. I am required to have a policy about these particular viewpoints that the government has defined.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like what we're seeing play out again in a case emanating from Colorado, the 303 Creative case that's before the Supreme Court on religious liberty, which is sort of a follow-up to the case, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, where the Colorado Civil Rights Commission is essentially setting what is required of private actors in terms of specific performance with what they do, whether it's baking cakes or designing websites. And the idea is it's all under the rubric of non-discrimination, but it's only particular kinds of alleged discrimination they're actually interested in. So it clearly is in these Colorado cases, and the Supreme Court's already held so in the Jack Phillips case. I think they're going to do the same in the 303 Creative case. It clearly is the government putting its finger on the scale for which viewpoints are acceptable and which viewpoints are not.
So I think that's right as to the New York law. As to the Colorado law, I co-wrote a brief that opposes that application of the Colorado law. But I don't think the Colorado law is viewpoint-based. The Colorado law does just ban discrimination based on race, religion, sexual orientation, and the like. It doesn't mention particular viewpoints as to speech. It just bans
status.
Discrimination. Most of its applications, it says, like, pardon?
It's status-based.
Well, right, but that's the same as, say, Title VII, the Employment Discrimination Law from 1964. Mm-hmm. It's the same as the Equal Protection Clause has been understood, or the Voting Rights Amendments talk about you can't discriminate in voting based on race or based on sex or based on age or having paid a poll tax, but they don't ban discrimination based on other things, like where you reside, let's say, or whether you're a citizen. You could have anti-discrimination laws that target conduct. The problem is, in this case, the Colorado law, that is to say, in the Colorado case, the Colorado law is requiring artists to create speech or speakers to create speech. And that's the problem. But in most of its applications, it isn't about speech, and it's viewpoint neutral. It's true it bans certain kinds of discrimination, but that's the nature of, again, a wide range of equality laws, anti-discrimination laws in the country.
Well, right. But, I mean, one wonders aloud what the Colorado civil rights minders would say if the Catholic Church said to an atheist or to a gay graphic designer, you're violating my religious liberty. You're violating my my constitutional rights by not designing this website the same way that an LGBT group is saying that or about the 303 Creative.
Well, I would say that in that kind of situation, I think Colorado courts and probably the commission, but certainly the courts would have an obligation to enforce the law the same way they're doing with regard to the the same-sex wedding site. I mean, it is pretty clear that the law would require people to film religious ceremonies for videographers or to create websites for religions, and you know, the Catholic Church would just be entitled to sue itself under the law. It's not even a matter of prosecutorial discretion, generally speaking. So I think they would have that right. I would hope that they wouldn't exercise it, because I'd hope they'd appreciate that that's an improper intrusion on people's individual conscience.
Exactly.
But
I
have no reason to think that Colorado courts would somehow try to get rid of that case, given that it's clearly covered by the law.
He is Professor Eugene Volokh. He's the co-founder of the Volokh Conspiracy Blog, and he's a law professor at UCLA. Professor Volokh, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Very much my pleasure. All the best.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.